Thank you for listening to the RSGB Talk podcast. This special episode has been recorded as part of the Festival of Road Safety. For all the latest festival content, please visit www.roadsafetygb.org.uk/festival.
Welcome to this, the third podcast that we're recording as part of the Festival of Road Safety. And today I'm joined, as usual, by my co-host, Edward Seaman. Do you want to say hello, Ed?
Hi, Nick. You're right.
Good, thanks. And our guest today is Ian Lewin, who's the Managing Director and Founder of DTEC International. And the topic today is drug driving. And we're going to try and delve a bit in to see if we can find out the real extent of the problem. Now, Ian came to our attention as the editors of Road Safety News newsfeed because he's a man who speaks his mind, I think. And we like that, of course. And we like that for podcasts as well. So we've engaged with him prior to this to find out if he would be up for talking to us today, because he's got strong views on drug driving, and that's what we want to hear today. So we're looking forward to talking to you, Ian.
Hello. I suppose first definition as an introduction is I'm Northern, and that's probably where the directness comes from. Good to meet you, gents.
Whereabouts in the north, Ian?
The office is up by Preston, Lancashire.
Okay, let's if we can open up by talking about you and DTEC International. Neither you nor DTEC International will be known to most of our listeners, I don't think. So would you mind just telling us a little bit about yourself and your company and how you became involved with and interested in the topic of drug driving?
I think most people won't have heard of us because we do try and fly below the radar, and most of our work is confidential. But at the moment, the situation is such that we've put our heads above the parapet and we're working with quite a lot of people to get the message out. And it's key that people remember this is all about understanding the message about drug driving, how dangerous it is and how prolific it is. But it all started in 1996. I met with a company in Germany who just invented this instant readout drug testing device on behalf of the German customs. The next step from there went into proving that they could detect drugs from the body rather than from luggage and items where it would be smuggled. So we'd been able to detect from the person. We were then able to move to drug drivers, and with that, the police side and also the workplace safety.
Did you say 25 years ago, almost 1996?
Yes, yes.
Why is it taking so long I'm
smiling to myself and remaining positive, but to work with government agencies to get something done takes a phenomenal amount of time. At the moment, I'm impressed with what they're achieving with the COVID scenario, but without that sort of pressure, I'm afraid most government institutions and bodies take an awful lot longer to get themselves organised. In this case, we have the Home Office that, shall we say, owns the police by being able to pay their salaries and fund the forces. And we have the Home Office also with most of the legislation. But we have the Department for Transport left with the safety on our roads. And between the pair of them, they have seriously been unable to get themselves organized. There's many, many good people in both organizations that would like to do better, mm-hmm. but we've just fallen between the cracks and there's been catch 22. We haven't got the legislation, so why write a type approval? Why get legislation if there's no type approval? And that took three Department for Transport select committees specifically on that issue before we actually did achieve both legislation in the Crown and Courts Act, which gave us Section 5A, drugs above a limit in the Road Traffic Act. And we also got a specification in which to fine-tune our devices to, because with everything with the UK, it has to be specific to us instead of the same device that is used across the rest of the world. So that went live in 2015, and that was after 17 years of hard work and after the UK being the first country in the world to actually run a drug driver's roadside screening trial back in 97, 98. So we went from being first in the world to, I'm afraid, almost back of the queue in 17 years.
It's extraordinary. That's an extraordinary length of time, isn't it? For the technology to have been around for the best part of 20 years before it was introduced in the UK seems to be an extraordinary thing, but there you go. So how, what is your interest in drug driving always been professional, or is there anything else beyond that? Imply that you're a drug driver, of course.
The interest came as a business proposition back in the mid 95, sort of 96, when I saw this technology being available. I've always been interested in new technology, but I went over to Germany and met the manufacturers, the designers, and I thought there would be an instant market here in the UK. It took 2 to 3 years to even get the first trials off the ground, and some good guys in the Department for Transport were driving that. But at the same time, I was also looking to see where we were in the workplace, naively thinking, well, the US has already got extensive workplace drug testing and we'd be 10 years behind them. Well, we're not. We're 30 years behind them and nowhere near at their level. So we're only just comprehending it at the police, at the roadside level, and we're only just realizing it, if we are realizing it, in the workplace.
Am I right in saying that DTEC International supplies the drug drive testing equipment to every police forces in England, Wales and Scotland?
You are perfectly correct. We're not supplying Northern Ireland yet because they don't have a legislator. They don't have the parliament to put that legislation in place. And yes, we've been providing England and Wales since 2015. We got every force up and running within a couple of months of the start of the legislation coming live. Then Scotland, they were running if you remember, they switched from the 35 level for alcohol down to the 22. Yeah, and they wanted to see a couple of years of the effects of that on their road safety statistics. So they were a bit behind us in actually starting drug driver screening with this device, although every one of their traffic officers is trained to a very high level to be able to field impairment test at the roadside. So they had a slightly different method, and they've seen the benefits, the massive benefits we've seen in the UK, sorry, in England and Wales. So they've now instigated that. And that was 1 year ago. They're already at double the number of tests being used above what they thought their plan would be.
Yeah. Should we talk a bit about drug drive statistics? In July, you said you were shocked by the number of drug drive arrests in the first half of 2020. Can you give us a little flavour of these stats and, you know, why you think they are shocking?
They're shocking in a way that you have to comprehend that I've been studying this for 25 years now, and we've been talking to traffic police up and down the country, and they all know that, or all knew that, drug driving was out there and it was growing. They knew that from talking to the drivers. The system that was in place at the time was very weak, because they wouldn't accept a perfectly good technology that we had. They wanted other people to be able to come in and compete. So they actually carried on with this field impairment test. So the traffic officers knew that many people were not drink driving, but they were drug driving because they knew they couldn't get caught.
Yeah.
In the 10 years prior to the Section 5A legislation, so 2005 to 2015, the level of arrests, if I say in 1 year it was 34 arrests for drug driving, and I'll be polite in saying that the average over those 10 years was something like just under 800. We went into our first year and immediately had our Section 5A arrests and convictions jumping to something like 8,000. So tenfold in a year from a standing start.
Yeah.
This has increased. We're now... I was asked to make a presentation to the International Conference on Drugs and Traffic Safety over in Canada, 2019. So I pulled together some figures, and with 4 years worth of the new legislation and the roadside screener and the traffic police all keen on this, we had caught 20 times the number of people on drugs than prior to this legislation. And what was also quite good was that the number of people arrested on being properly impaired, in other words, failing the roadside field impairment test, that had doubled. So people were not only more confident in doing it, that the doctors and the other people involved in, let's say, the process were also getting more involved, getting more specialist. And then with the 20 times as many going through from the roadside screener, they were above the limit in the same way as a breathalyzer would say, you are above the limit. This went through, the samples went through the laboratories, and CPS was getting better at fending off the ridiculous arguments that these no win, no fee loophole lawyers were coming up with. And so now we're in a situation that I thought we were getting to a magnitude of events. But earlier this year, we were talking to a number of forces that were now up to 2,000 arrests each force, the first one being Essex and the second one being Merseyside. But in those, they were then carrying on into January, February, March, and their figures were going through the roof to the extent that Essex was seeing 2.5 to 3 times the level of drug driver arrests to alcohol. And this wasn't a lack of doing alcohol, of drink drive. This, they were still having very good, if not record figures there. It's the case that the people that were on the road were the people, A, abusing the system and the lockdown, but they were also on drugs, and the police had time to deal with them. So that's what really shocked me. 3 times the level of drugs to the amount of alcohol, drink drive.
Presumably, Ian, there's a difference in the level of drug drive testing going on between police forces?
I'm afraid to say there is. And this isn't me being northern. What is fantastic, if anybody has the chance to Google search the Parliamentary Advisory Committee on Transport Safety, one of their recent reports was excellent. It was talking about roads policing, and it went into great depth about drug driver screening, the whole side of things through the roads policing. And basically, we don't have enough traffic police. They are also wearing many hats. They're having to do many other tasks other than their core training and their core skills. They're not on the road to actually be effective in making our roads safer for everyone. So this report goes through to explain why we're in this situation. And it's everything from having elected PCCs. Now, for whatever good they are over the old system, it's not for me to comment. But one of the things that they're not doing is mentioning traffic police when in their manifesto. This is seen as a vote loser. Everybody thinks traffic police speeding. Can't be having that. I want to carry on driving as I drive. I'm a very good driver. And so police and crime commissioners don't put it in their manifesto. They still get voted in. You then have a chief constable who is the operational arm, shall we say. And because he's not been asked to, he or she has not been asked to emphasize the roads policing, they don't. And this filters all the way down. And now we're in a situation that I think in the last 10 years, we're down to a third of the number of traffic police. And as I say, even then, they're doing other jobs at the same time. So this is a very serious issue. The Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary, and they were called in by the Department for Transport, and their review is shocking. It actually, it changed its title to Roads Policing, Not Optional. And their report says the system is wrong and there's not enough traffic police out there to enforce the legislation that we as a society have chosen to have. And with that is where I see my drug driving issue having been allowed to expand and increase to a ridiculous level. So we treat drink driving as socially unacceptable. So when I tell you there's three times the level of drug driving going on, I'll leave it to your own conclusion.
Yeah, it took a little while for drink driving to become socially unacceptable, didn't it? I can't remember exactly how long it was, but certainly when the legislation was first introduced, it was not seen as socially unacceptable. You're seen as unlucky if you got caught. And I guess it's the same with drug driving to some extent. There will be a little bit of a culture shift there's got to be in terms of the perception of it happening.
I'll fill you in with a couple of figures. I'm pretty target driven. I'm pretty dynamic person. So when we got the new legislation in 2015, 2nd of March, I said, I am not going to let this take the 50 years that it took to get drink drive unacceptable.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this in 5.
Okay.
Well, we cracked on, we achieved. Well, when I say we, I have to be absolutely clear with you. This is all the traffic guys that are out there. Many of their managers, supervisors, some of the civilians that work with them, other entities like Project Edward. There's so many other people involved in this. I've just given them the biro with which to work. And it's them that have to drive it. So we have the legislation, we have the technology, we then have to have these keen officers. And believe me, we're told drug wipe is the best piece of policing equipment that's ever been invented. So we take that with a thank you very much. What can we do to make it better? And it's the system we need to make better. And at the moment, my target is, I don't want that to take 50 years. Something that just came out last week. Baroness Veer, Minister of Transport, in answer to a question from, I think it was Lord Rigsby, so published in Hansard, came back with a reply that showed there was 441 people died in the last 5 years from drugs and driving. Yeah. There was 1,500 serious injuries involved in, sorry, there was 1,500 collisions. The problem was the wrong question was asked. We need to ask how many people were seriously injured and how many people were minor injuries. Remembering that serious injury is defined as life-changing, loss of limb, this sort of magnitude of serious injury. But I find 441. Now, I actually think that is a big underestimate because the report came from one system, the old system, the old Stats 19 system.
Yeah.
I would like to have had those numbers added to the new system, which is the crash system, which would probably show a similar number. So we're looking at double what was reported. This is when I know that I have to remain northern and abrupt because I have to get past these ideas that civil servants and ministers and our elected people are more worried about that than they are about saying, sugar, we have a significant problem. Let's go look at it.
Can we switch our attention for a moment to talk about the corporate environment, please, if that's okay, and drug driving?
Sure.
And so because it's not just an enforcement issue, is it? In terms of the police, there are other players in this as well, I guess. So what would a good drug drive testing regime look like in an organisation from your perspective? Should fleet managers, fleet owners, and company owners be testing daily, weekly, monthly, or at random? And who should they be testing? Should it just be the professional drivers within the organisation? Should it be anyone that drives as part of their job, or all employees? What's your view on that?
All of the above is the simple answer. But to put that into context, we have well over 300 customers on our cards, and they range from everything from somebody with a couple of vans or a couple of wagons, all the way up through to national and even multinational bus and truck companies. I suppose the bigger guys call themselves logistics because we work in their warehouses as well as their drivers of their heavies. On the buses, we do an awful, I'll leave it at an awful lot of the bus companies across the UK. And just as an example, we probably do 75% of the bus companies contracted to TfL. So if it's a red bus in London, three quarters of them will be screening. Now, one of our longest customers, 20 odd years, it's best if I describe how we moved forwards within their organization. We started off with the logical thing, which is let's test the bus drivers. They're the ones that are going to cause the biggest problems. They're the ones potentially the highest risk. Until somebody realizes that the young lass in the front office that has to go and drop some forms off with the engineering manager in the workshop at the back of the bus depot, she is personally at risk. She's just as much at risk. So we moved then into also the engineers working on the buses, making sure they're safe, and all the staff. And to make it properly fair and across the board, we also do the managers and all the directors, because they are out there going to see customers, going to see the government. They're driving whilst at work. They're driving to and from work. Yeah, so everybody.
How often would a TfL bus driver get tested?
What we look at is, and sadly, this is not a commercial argument. Sadly, there's no specification as to what is good practice. Yeah. We have certain customers who, let's say, do the bare minimum, but we're working with them to improve. We have other customers that are doing what we would consider, have followed our advice, to be a respectable level of testing. And so we would pre-employment test, so we keep the problem out of their company. We then do with causes, we find out whether the drugs and alcohol are an issue. And it's a benefit to be able to say to your insurer, drugs and alcohol were not an issue. And then we do random. Now, the question is, why do we do random? We work on a policy, educate, deter, then detect. And if we haven't done enough, if detection is too high, we haven't done enough of the policy. We haven't got the policy right, maybe. We haven't done enough of the education as to why it's a dodgy thing to be taking drugs and coming to work. And we haven't created a significant enough deterrent. So we work on that, and we work through with each customer to move them forward until we find a reduction in the number of detections. Then we know we've got a handle on things. So this can be somebody being chosen at random every couple of years.
Right.
Now, if I was to just put that into perspective, if you're working on British Rail, their system is 5% of safety critical. So first off, you have to be safety critical, and not many people are. actually. And then, do you know? Do you understand that 5% random would mean you are only chosen once in once every 20 years?
Yeah.
So that doesn't sound very significant deterrent to me.
No.
So we look at, when we say 50% testing, people sort of have a little bit of a freak because they think, 50%, half my people. But half their people every year is only being tested every couple of years, every 2 years. So majority of our, let's say, understanding customers that realize what we're trying to help them achieve, they're looking at maybe once every 3 years or once every 2 years.
Yeah, great. Good. Well, thank you very much for answering that question. That pretty much draws us to a close, actually. But I'd just like to say thank you, Ian, for spending the time with us today. It's been really interesting, and I'm sure our listeners are going to enjoy it. We look forward to speaking to you again at some point in the future about this issue.
Certainly, and hopefully it's in a time when we can be saying, well, there's some good news, and we're reacting in the workplace and we're reacting at the roadside.
Thanks, Ed, as well.
Cheers, thank you very much.
Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.